This is A Coastal Story, written and presented by Charlie Connolly. This year, the average price for a beach hut in Britain topped £50,000. The average price. 50 grand. Not long ago, a beach hut at Muddiford Spit in Dorset sold for, get this, £355,000. But the average price, 50 grand. For a shed. A shed that generally has no electricity, no running water, in fact, no utilities or facilities whatsoever. Unless you're lucky enough to get one that has a built-in fold-out table. It's a shed. A shed you're not even allowed to stay the night in. Each to their own. It's about a century since people started having more leisure time on their hands, and Britain's seaside towns began to fill up each summer with people escaping the cities. The beach hut, a direct and stationary descendant of the bathing carriage that would roll in and out of the surf during Georgian times, became wildly popular in the years after the First World War, springing up in rows on beaches up and down the country. So popular, and so new were they, that newspapers began advising people on what to do with their beach hut. In 1925, The Guardian informed its readers the beach hut was a cosy dressing room for bathers, an open-air dining room, a kitchen, and a pantry all rolled into one. Helpfully, they added that a shelf is most convenient to store such things as tea, coffee, salt, sugar, and biscuits. Deck chairs were recommended, but also camping chairs, for stout and elderly visitors who often have strong objections to the ordinary deck chair. The Aberdeen Press and Journal was a little more practical in 1934 in an article called Furnishing the Beach Hut. Now, you need to imagine this next bit in the voice of, say, Celia Johnson or even Margaret Rutherford. When first taken over, the beach hut is probably quite bare of furniture, unless it has a bench, a shelf, and perhaps a flap table. The first task, therefore, is to complete the furnishing, equip it with crockery and the necessary cutlery and utensils, and make it attractive by means of cheery curtains and cushions. The furnishings of a beach hut should be as bright as possible, and one can safely give rein to a liking for colour. Of course, if you are only the temporary owner of the beach hut, you can hardly do anything to brighten the interior paintwork. But this is usually white, which is a good background for the bright touches you can give the furniture, and for the gay crockery you'll hang about the walls. Gay cottage china will fit right in the beach hut. A double row of shelves can be converted into a useful cupboard if a short curtain is hung to cover the lower one. On the lower shelf, you can conceal all the stores and food containers that are not ornamental, and keep the top shelf for displaying the china. This explosion in the popularity of beach huts did have drawbacks, however. There were plenty of occasions when whole rows of them were reduced to matchwood by storms, and barely a summer week went by between the wars without at least one oil-fired stove going over in a beach hut somewhere and burning it, and frequently its neighbours, to the ground. Although little of value was usually left in beach huts, break-ins were common. Burglars were usually disappointed with what they found, a couple of drying towels maybe, or perhaps some gay crockery hung about the walls. But that was generally it. In Exmouth, one night in June 1930, 18 beach huts in a line were broken into. But nothing was taken beyond about sixpence in coppers. In fact, the burglar left behind more than he swiped. One owner found his lock broken, but not only was nothing taken, there was a half-eaten banana and a chocolate biscuit with one bite out of it on the table that wasn't there the day before. In a hut further along the row, someone found a pair of clean socks missing, and a pair of recently worn socks left in their place. Sometimes beach huts were broken into as a last resort by those who, for whatever reason, didn't have a bed for the night. Seaside towns have always had a curious pull for runaways. Maybe it's the idea of a horizon, the endless possibility suggested by the line where sea and sky meet. Maybe it's these towns' transient natures, how they fill and empty with day trippers and holiday makers, different faces passing through, making it easy to be anonymous among the crowds. But when night falls, and the streets become as empty as your pockets, the seaside can be a forbidding place. The wind off the sea has a chill that's absent during the day. The encroaching tide looks sinister in the dark as you lay shivering on the beach. You try to find a boat to climb into, but then you see that line of beach huts. The law of averages says that one of them will be open, surely. If not, well, it wouldn't take much of a kick to break off that padlock bolt. You won't take anything. You just need somewhere to see out the night. You'll be gone long before anyone comes in the morning. It had been a rainy night when, at 3:45 on the morning of the 27th of September 1935, P.C. Hunt, patrolling the Eastern Parade at Bexhill-on-Sea, saw the bolt on beach hut number 46 was pulled back. Most likely the owner had forgotten to close it, but as there had been a theft from one of the huts the previous week, P.C. Hunt thought he should just check to be sure. He tried to open the door, but found it was locked from the inside. He walked to the window and lifted his lamp. Its beams swept around the hut, and he saw the sleeping forms of a young man and a young woman stretched out on the floor. He went back to the door and knocked firmly, and heard movement and some frantic whispering. He knocked again, but this time everything was quiet. He wrenched the door open, and there, faces screwed up in the glare of his lamp, was a young couple huddled against the rear wall. When the policeman asked what they were doing in there, the young man said they had nowhere to stay and just wanted to shelter out of the rain for the night. They'd found the hut unlocked, he said. They wouldn't take anything. The owners wouldn't even know they'd been there. Twenty-four-year-old Edwin Wilson had met 20-year-old Gwendolyn Hurst when she'd taken his order in a Bexhill cafe at the start of the summer. He'd just lost yet another labouring job and was killing a bit of time before going home to Hastings. He liked the smile she gave him as she popped her order pad back into her apron pocket, and she'd noticed the dimples that appeared when he smiled back. It wasn't long before they were in love, and Edwin had abandoned the Hastings home he shared with his wife. For Gwendolyn, raised in a strict Salvation Army family in Hampshire, Edwin promised a new life and a new start. She'd come to Bexhill newly qualified as a nurse, but hated the job and soon packed it in, finding waitressing work instead and renting a tiny room in the eaves of a boarding house that managed to be freezing cold even at the height of summer. At the start of September, with the summer season finishing, Gwendolyn's job came to an end. The couple ended up sleeping wherever they could, on the shingle, in beach shelters, And that night, that rain-soaked night, they'd found a beach hut unlocked and thought their luck was changing at last. Until, that is, the door opened, and there was the silhouetted outline of a policeman in his rain cape reaching for his lamp. They were both charged with breaking and entering. Edwin had given the address of a friend in Hastings where he'd gone after first leaving his wife, and PC Hunt suspected Edwin had something to do with the previous break-in. And sure enough, when he searched the Hastings address, there was the tablecloth and the crockery that had been reported stolen. In court, Edwin was sent to prison for 2 months with hard labour. Gwendolyn was given 12 months probation. She waited for him, though, and when he came out of prison, she was there to meet him. She'd never been so happy to see anyone. They moved to Brighton. He found work, she found work, and they built a life together. Edwin's wife never granted him a divorce, so they had to wait until her death in 1972 before they could marry. And after 37 years together, Gwendolyn finally became Mrs. Wilson. They moved to Hastings, where Edwin died in 1986. Gwendolyn missed him terribly. She lived to see the fireworks over the sea that announced the new millennium, and made it to the age of 91 before she died in 2006. Sometimes, every few years, they'd take the train to Bexhill, walk along the East Parade, and count the beach huts until they found number 46. Sometimes, if nobody was around, they'd try the door. That was A Coastal Story, and I'm Charlie Connolly. Coastal Stories is free to listen to, giving you ample opportunity to save up your 50 grand for that beach hut. And you can follow us for free too, on Twitter and Facebook. The links are in the show notes. If you're not saving up 50 grand for a beach hut, you can of course buy Coastal Stories a pint via the link that's also in the show notes. Hope you all got through the heatwave okay. See you next time.